on the app, online, and across the Cape on 567 AM.
Lunch with Pippa Hudson on Cape Talk. Join the conversation.
It's a warm welcome back to our listeners listening on 567 and on the Cape Talk app, but a special word of welcome to our live studio audience members who've joined us for the second hour of the show today. I don't think I've ever seen a crowd this large in our live studio audience area. Thank you so much, everybody, for being with us today, and welcome. And the reason for the size of the crowd is the woman sitting next to me, who is our guest of honor today, Indian writer Arundhati Roy. Like many other readers, I was moved beyond words by her debut novel, The God of Small Things, which won her the Man Booker Prize in 1997. And it was a very long 20 years wait for the follow-up novel, The Ministry of Utmost Happiness. But I think everyone here today will agree it was worth waiting for. And of course, in between, her pen has not lain still. She has written and spoken on a variety of different issues, from nationalist politics and minority rights to Kashmiri independence, violence against women, many issues that I hope we have a chance to touch on today. But Arundhati, first and foremost, welcome to South Africa, welcome to Cape Town, and thank you for being so generous with your time today. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
We are giving a full hour over to exploring both her fiction and non-fiction work. So the audience at home, please remember you can join the conversation with a tweet, with an SMS to 31567, a call to 021-446-0567, or by leaving a voice note on 072-567-1567. Those of you here in the studio who haven't already submitted questions in advance, please just raise a hand at any time if you'd like to join the conversation, and we will make space for that. I want to start with the label of activist, because when I started prepping for this interview, Arundhati, initially I was going to introduce you as an author and activist. And then I came across a transcript of an interview where you actually questioned the use of that term. And you're someone who writes about things that you see as wrong in the world, whether those be political in nature, social in nature, even the building of a dam that threatens people's livelihoods. Does that not count as activism? What do you feel so strongly about that term?
No, it's not that I feel strongly about the term, but I keep wondering, when was that word invented? You know, it's quite a recent word. And I say that writing more or less covers what I do, you know. And in a way, the necessity of adding activist to the profession of someone who's a writer, to me, it sort of symbolizes what has become of writing. You know that in the olden days, we had writers who wrote about the things they believed in, what was happening in the world. They were beheaded, they were persecuted, and so on. And now writers are increasingly being seen as entertainers who have to live somewhere between bestseller lists and literature festivals, mm-hmm. and leave the politics outside. And activists are really people who have a resilience and a stubbornness, who stay on and in the same place, saying the same things again and again. And I don't think I qualify for that. You know, I'm somebody who writes about the society that I live in or the world that I see, and I feel that I inhabit everything that a writer needs to inhabit without needing an extra profession added to what I do.
The writing itself is an extra profession, because I think many listeners will be interested to know you originally qualified as an architect.
Yes. I studied architecture and worked for a while in cinema. But I think that writing a novel is the best way of practicing architecture.
How so?
Actually,
that's an intriguing answer.
Yeah, because it's you know, to me, writing a novel, the structure of a novel is an endlessly fascinating thing, and the structure of the novel in The God of Small Things was intricate. You know, one thread of the book was over a period of a day, and then it moved through many years in another direction. Mm. But when I wrote The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, after of course these 20 years of writing pretty overtly political essays and traveling and engaging with the world in the ways I had, I felt that what I needed to write now could not be contained in nonfiction. However, the more or less traditional, not that there is a traditional idea, but what we have come to see as a novel was also somewhat constraining for me. So I thought, can I write a story which is like a city, a big metropole in the part of the world that I live in, like a city like Delhi, huge, bewildering, confusing, ancient, modern, planned, unplanned, always inscribing itself in form against the contours of nature. However, I felt, you know, a story in which you have highways and narrow streets and alleyways where you don't walk past anybody without stopping to say hello, you know. Complicated for a reader, but very satisfying for a writer somehow, where you break out of this idea that a novel is just about a few people set against a particular context or background, either a very personal one or a vast one, like War and Peace or something. Mm. But to me, the idea of a story, not the setting of a story, but the structure of a story, like a city, where sometimes the background becomes the foreground, the idea of a... I did write and work in city planning a lot. So the idea of how cities came to be what they are has always fascinated me. And so the ministry is like that, you know. It even begins in the ancient medieval part of Delhi and then sort of starts swirling outwards. And you constantly got these layers of modernity and tradition superimposed on each other.
We had a question about structure. If I can ask my producer to get the microphone to Jess at the back of the room with the purple hair. Quite easy to spot. Jess, welcome and great to have you with us. You had a question about structure going back to the first novel, The God of Small Things.
How did you find the courage to play with words and sentence structure in God of Small Things as a debut author?
Before I wrote The God of Small Things, I had written two screenplays for cinema. And when you live in India, you know, language is something that is fascinating because, you know, it's a country where there are 35 official languages and 43 waiting to be declared official. Sure. And 730 recognized languages. And one moves through languages in ways which are pretty fascinating, you know. And so the search for a language that somehow isn't necessarily in some formal way your mother tongue, however it's the language that you've grown up with among other languages. And so The God of Small Things, I was really thinking of it in two languages, English and Malayalam, each of them informing the other. And one of the reasons that there was what you call courage is because I was convinced that I was writing something that seven people would read. You know, I was really just experimenting in a way which didn't require courage. I was just playing, you know. And then when I wrote The Ministry, it came from a different place where, again, you know, it is a book that is imagined in many languages. And, you know, the success of even just the commercial success of The God of Small Things gave me two options. You know, one is, am I going to play it safe and write The Son of the God of Small Things? Or can I really roll the dice, you know, and try to write, look for another kind of language? So in the case of The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, it was almost like taking the language of The God of Small Things and nudging it off a very tall building and then running down and picking up the shards, because you know, I needed a fractured, edgy, broken language in that, which keeps shifting with the terrain and with characters. But either way, for me, there is. I don't think of it as courageous because I it's too pleasurable to be courageous, you know. It's play.
Arundhati, I think perhaps the reason that this room is so full of people today of many different ages as well is a good symbol to you of how much the God of Small Things in particular resonated with us here in South Africa. It is at its heart about people choosing to love where their hearts lead them and not where society tells them their hearts should lead them. And, of course, that's an issue that we grappled with in South Africa. We didn't just grapple with it. We had it written into law under apartheid, our Immorality Act, which made it a crime to love across the colour line, for example. So you can imagine how much meaning that story had for readers here and really still does. What made you want to write about that particular issue, the so-called the law of love? And, Lyle, we have a follow-up question after that, but first, if you could respond, why that particular issue?
Look, this is not an issue, you know. It is the very stuff of life. In India, we live and have lived with the caste system, which is centuries, thousands of years old. The difference between perhaps a society where race is written into law and in which this form of social, the brutal, perhaps the most brutal form of social hierarchy human society could conceive of, which is caste, in which certain people are thought of as untouchables, unseeables, unthinkables, not written into law, but sanctioned divinely. Can you imagine the horror of that? You know, so India is a society that today, because the color coding of caste is not as clear as the color coding of race in apartheid South Africa, but it is a society that I consider to be practicing apartheid in India. And it's shocking to me, the reverse is shocking to me, that more people don't write about it, that upper caste people, the Brahmins, who are like the white people of India, can occupy positions of power, can write about, see, Brahmins are just upper caste, but what we refer to as Brahminism is a complex kind of racism where even within the untouchable castes there are hierarchies. So it's a way of thinking, of a vertical or a linear way of thinking as opposed to a horizontal one, you know, so a lateral one. So to me, it's not that I chose to write about this issue, but that this is the very air we breathe. And if you don't write about the air you breathe, then what else you write about, you know? So to me, the complicated, complex, twisted yoga position is not writing about it or acting as if it doesn't exist when it does.
Thank you. I know Lyle had a follow-up question on the same subject. Lyle, welcome.
Hello. The law of love seems to be this universal law that detects who we should love and how much. And for me, the God of Small Things was, in its entirety, was an act of defiance against this law. If you were to say, update this law, rewrite the law, revise it, what did this new law look like and how would it direct the way we should love?
You know, the whole point is that there shouldn't be a law, right? Because if you have a law, then that just militates against the idea altogether. So when I said the love laws about who should be loved and how, so if you replace that with another law, you'll still be creating barriers, you know. So human society will always have them. They will always have these areas of the sacred and the profane. Each society will have different areas that are sacred and different areas that are profane. And you will always have those who challenge them.
Now, speaking of challenging the sacred and the profane and the response to that, I had a look at your Facebook page a little earlier today, and my producer and I were both quite stunned by what we saw there in terms of the criticism. Well, there is an Arundhati Roy page that somebody has created for you, and on it were... you might want to check it. Although, actually, I don't know if you want to check it out, because on it was a lot of pushback from critics saying things along the lines of, you should renounce your Indian passport because of your criticism of the government, that you do not deserve to be regarded as a citizen any longer, in one memorable comment that you deserved a good slap, and I quote. I'm sure it's not the first time you've heard that kind of thing. You must live with it on a daily basis. I'm interested to know, though, how different the reaction has been to the Ministry of Utmost Happiness versus what you received following the publication of The God of Small Things. 20 years have passed in between. Has society changed that much? Has its openness to your message and your themes changed at all?
Well, first of all, let me say that I would be horrified if those people liked me. You know, that
that deserves a round of applause.
That would be when I started really worrying. That's a complicated question you've asked, so let me see if I can just hopscotch through the answer. When The God of Small Things came out, apart from, you know, all the good things that happened to it, which you all know, so every few years this happens to me. It started with The God of Small Things, that five male lawyers get together and file a criminal case against me. In the case of The God of Small Things, it was for corrupting public morality.
Wow.
As if, you know, public morality was pure until I came along. But I was like, can it be for further corrupting public morality? But anyway, that had to do, of course, with the transgression and the Amu and Velita love story. The case was eventually dropped 10 years later. But soon after The God of Small Things was published, well within months after the Booker Prize and so on happened, the Indian politics took a very sharp turn to the right. A right-wing Hindu nationalist government came to power, and one of the first things it did was to conduct a series of nuclear tests. Mm. Now, that was at the time when I was on the cover of every magazine as this item of national pride, you know, along with Miss Universe and all of that. So when the nuclear test happened, it wasn't just the idea of what nuclear war and all of that. It was just a turning point in the public discourse, the national public discourse in India just turned. And suddenly things which were unsayable in public began to be said. And I wrote an essay called The End of Imagination about what has happened, this sort of orgy of nationalism that soon became Hindu nationalism, which saw Muslims as second-class citizens, which celebrated this kind of mob violence and so on. So I wrote this essay, and I said that if it's anti-national and anti-Hindu and I talked about how you know, the idea of nuclear weapons colonizes your imagination. So I said, if it's anti-national and anti-Hindu to have nuclear weapons implanted in my brain, then I secede. Mm. I declare myself a mobile republic, which is the point at which the nationalists all turn against me, feeling very betrayed, because I was, of course, at that point the
poster child,
the poster girl. And subsequently for the last 20 years, I have actually interrogated this idea of nationalism, you know, because when you have nationalism, it soon becomes a form of a manifesto of hatred, a manifesto of declaring then who is the rightful citizen and who is not, who can have the water, who can have, and every form of violence against the poor, displacement, privatization, structural adjustment, all of it done in the name of nationalism, all of it done to empower a middle class and to disempower a vast mass of people. And so, and then of course there was the issue of the military occupation of Kashmir. I mean, where you have three of the world's greatest democracies, America, Israel, and India, all three running the world's great military occupations, you know. And you're not allowed to say a thing about it in India. You're not allowed to talk about the fact that hundreds of young Kashmiris have had pellet guns fired into their eyes, have been blinded, have thousands of people have been killed, and you speak about it, and they say, you know, take away her citizenship or disempower. And truth be told, that isn't, I mean, they would like to say that they are the voice of the nation, but that's not true. I mean, to come back to your question about how was the Ministry of Utmost Happiness received in India, probably outsold every other literary book by, hundreds
tenfold,
of times.
Hundredfold, I mean, yeah.
It's pirated, it's sold on the streets. It's sold to me. Would you like to buy at the traffic lights?
Join the conversation
on the Cape Talk app, online and across the Cape on 567 AM.
You're with Cape Talk.
We continue our conversation with Indian author Arundhati Roy. Her first novel, The God of Small Things, won the Man Booker Prize for Fiction in 1997. Last year, I know many of you were delighted to finally have the chance to read her second work of fiction, The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, myself included, by the way. And Ryan has got a question about what happened in between. Ryan, great to have you with us.
Hello, thanks for taking my question. It's an absolute honor to see you, Ms. Roy. After publishing your debut novel with this magnificent, you know, work of literature that rightfully made this splash, how is it in a way that you were able to suppress your very rich literary imagination for so long? I know that you devoted yourself to incredibly important causes. I know you don't want to be called an activist, but that must have been in some senses quite difficult. Did you not see a way to maybe balance your political essays and analysis and maybe writing fiction? Because there is quite a big gap between, you know, your two novels.
Well, the thing is that the 20 years that I spent between the two books, first of all, when I wrote The God of Small Things, I was not, and I've never been somebody who thinks that I have to sort of produce a lot of work, you know. The God of Small Things is The God of Small Things because It's a dense book, you know. It's about. It took me 4 years to write, and it was. It wasn't something that I could see myself just producing another book every 3 years or 5 years or something. But the thing is that the essays that I wrote for 20 years were also a literary genre. They were also stories, you know, also told in ways which actually challenged me as a writer. For instance, when I went first into the valley of the Narmada River, where there were these huge dams being built, and I began to understand the scale of the destruction and also the beauty of the resistance, it was to me a challenge, you know. So I said, okay, Roy, you can write about childhood and about love stories. Can you make people read about irrigation? Like, what kind of, let's see you do that, you know? And so it was a delightful writing exercise as well. And so the 20 years of political writing, I see myself, and when I read those essays, in fact, I've been reading them now for the last few weeks, because they're all going to be collected into a book called My Seditious Heart. And so expect a few more insults on Facebook. but the thing is that my way of writing everything is a form of storytelling, you know. And I could not have written the Ministry of Utmost Happiness without those 20 years of deepening my understanding of the world I lived in, of the people I lived with. To me, a novel isn't just something that is beautiful and glittering and the reader can consume. It has to be something that consumes the reader. You know, it has to be a world in which readers have to live, however hard it is, you know. So I couldn't have written it without these years of experience, which turned me into a sort of sedimentary rock, a person with layers and layers and layers. And finally, all that travel, all those engagements, all the expansion of my own imagination by meeting the kinds of people and the kinds of life stories and the kinds of struggle and being involved in them myself, not merely from the outside. When you write fiction, then it's what sweats out on your skin. Your ink is the sweat on your skin, you know? It's so processed. So while the essays were interventions and arguments and quarrels and hooliganism on my part in that part of the world, fiction is using all that to then construct a universe through which you invite somebody you care about to walk with you, you know? So it's a much more... I mean, the Ministry of Utmost Happiness is a much more difficult book than The God of Small Things, but it's difficult because, in a way, it's more ambitious. It's informed by 20 years of knowing things that I would never have known had I not engaged in these ways, and entering universes into which I would never have been invited had I not been the writer that I am. For example, as an Indian, you can't enter the world of Kashmir in the way I have had it not been for the writing that I've done previously, challenging things, you know? So in a way, long ago I once said that I wish, it's like you want to be rewarded not with royalties, but by the ability to go somewhere and say, hey, I wrote The End of Imagination, or I wrote The God of Small Things, will you give me lunch, you know? And in a way, that has been my real reward, that I can, I am invited into the heart of things that are happening, which I could not have in any other, not with the Booker Prize, not with any other form of celebrity, but only because of what I have written in the past.
Thank you. We spoke earlier about how the themes of love, forbidden love, resonated with us here in South Africa. Another strong theme in both of your books and in your nonfiction writing is another one which will resonate very strongly here, the abuse of women and misogyny and patriarchy. We know you have a problem in India. You know we have a huge problem in South Africa in terms of violence against women, and it's something that is woven into your stories. In fact, you're sitting here in the middle of our Women's Month, which is meant to be a celebration and a commemoration of the role of women in fighting back against apartheid, but in many cases has just become a pink-covered marketing campaign for the month of August. And I'm wondering how you feel visiting South Africa, where many women, I think you could possibly even say most women, live to a degree in a constant state of anxiety. Anxiety about their physical safety, anxiety about the obstacles in their way to success. How is your society in India shifting, or is it shifting? I think there was a follow-up question here from Fazia wanting to know about changes with this regard since you published The God of Small Things.
So I'm rereading The God of Small Things. It takes a long time because it's so deep and so exquisite. So the part with the lady, I can't remember their names, with the pickles and the jams, and how the sun just comes and takes over everything. So to me, where is patriarchy now and matriarchy from 1997 to today? Is there a shift? Is there something better that has come out that you could mention to us?
Well, from the early 90s, there was a huge change in the Indian economy. In South Africa, you had the end of apartheid and the beginning of structural adjustment and privatization together, whereas India had independence in 1947 and 50 years of a sort of nation building, building institutions of education and so on before structural adjustment came and started to break it down. So you have today a situation where there is a movement forward and backward at the same time. So you have a lot of young women who have entered the workspace, which wasn't the case earlier. There's a lot of anxiety and violence against them for that process of modernization. However, the old feudal system had its own institutionalized forms of hierarchy and violence against women. For example, upper caste men had the right to walk into a lower caste house and just take the women over, or the forest department was constantly able to pick up women in the forest, indigenous tribal women, and, you know, do what they liked. In truth, the situation regarding women is extremely complicated now. Still, you've all read about India being declared one of the most unsafe places in the world for women. But, you know, unfortunately, you can't even break this down that simply into women and men, because like with the rise of Hindu nationalism, you see things which are so terrifying. For instance, 2 months ago, a little shepherd girl, Muslim shepherd girl, was raped, caught hold of 8-year-old girl, kidnapped, held in a small sort of makeshift village temple in Jammu and Kashmir, in the Jammu area of Kashmir, where she was forced to have psychotic drugs and then raped and finally killed and dumped in the forest. But you had millions of people, thousands of people, including women, marching in support of the rapists, you know, marching to change the course of the trial. So you had when in 2002, when our current Prime Minister Modi was the Chief Minister of Gujarat, he was Chief Minister. He belongs to a Hindu supremacist outfit called the RSS, and there was a massive pogrom against Muslims on the streets of Gujarat. Muslim women were burnt, were raped, were killed. And the outrage was not women versus men. It was a communal conflagration where there were women who also supported the Hindu right. There are huge organizations of women who support the Hindu right. You know, so I'm uncomfortable about these easy breakdowns as well. And as for patriarchy, obviously, you know, India is a society where patriarchy is firmly in place. You know, so often one of the frustrating things is that people talking about violence against women, people talking about sexual harassment, forget that the feminist battle was not only about that, but about patriarchy, about the right to entitlement. About it is not just about sexual harassment and rape and violence, but also about sexism and patriarchy and power, you know?
Yeah, thank you, Fasia. Interesting question came in by email from Bianca, who I think is with us today, but she is in the publishing industry. And her question for you was whether the psychology of any of your characters has ever affected your own way of thinking, that they spring forth from you, but do they inform back into you in turn?
Well, in particular, when I was writing The Ministry, which is a fractured book, as I said, a novel that wants to be a city. But one of the main characters in the book He's a character who, his name is Biplob Dasgupta, but he goes by the name of Garson Hobart, because that's the name of the character he plays in a college play, and all the his friends call him that. And he's a senior, when we first meet him, he's a pretty senior intelligence officer. And when I started to write him, he began to tell his own story in first person, you know. And I try to say, you just can't do this in the middle of a book, you know. You can't start speaking in first person. It's not done. But he wasn't going to listen. And he was actually, in a way, you know, each of the characters in this book has a sort of incendiary border running through them. The character called Anjum has a border of gender running through her. There's a character called Saddam Hussein who has a border of religious conversion running through him. And Garson Hobart, in a way, also is a sort of trans character, because he's half the voice of this very erudite, sort of earlier secular Nehruvian Indian state, as upper caste and as, in a way, his violence is a sophisticated violence, you know. And half of him is this sort of increasingly drunk, thwarted lover who's very hard on himself, very self-deprecating about himself. But as I was writing him, I knew that this was, in some ways, my nemesis, you know, in some ways, the antagonist that had to be brilliant. You know, I wasn't going to create easy meat, someone who I could just defeat in an argument, but somebody who's just on the other side of the line, but somebody whose intellect is on par with yours, you know, the enemy you wouldn't want to have in some ways. And that is what I mean when you write fiction, that you can't, it's a slightly dangerous and esoteric process. You know, there's another character called Amrik Singh, who's a captain in the Indian Army, who begins by being a sort of executioner on orders from the state. But then, obviously, that system, that military occupation, gives him the latitude to develop his manias, you know, and he becomes someone who's slightly out of control. However, he's not just some serial killer, you know, some sex maniac. He's somebody who the system has created and who then takes advantage of that impunity. So in understanding how this very sophisticated democracy operates, how they allow people to express themselves and wear themselves out before going after them, how in Kashmir they allowed, you know, when the insurrection begins, they have no idea who are the people who are underneath it, you know. So one of the things Hobart says they did is to begin to fund an anti-state newspaper, and through that they got the names of who are the thinkers behind this, you know. So these things are very disturbing when you begin to write, because you're creating something which is, you skate pretty close to a kind of insanity, you know.
But also that very thin line between the fiction and the non-fiction, as you've said. I mean, I want to quote you back at yourself here. I came across this in one of your previous interviews that I thought was so interesting, that you spoke about your delicate fiction in India, the upholding of this nation as the land of Gandhi and yoga and non-violence, when in fact there has not been a single day since August 1947, when India was declared independent, that the Indian Army has not been deployed within its own borders against its own people. How worried are you about the current state of your nation?
Well, my nation, I'm an anti-national, forget.
Apologies, but bad to express, yeah.
As they say. But I got to say, I have never been more worried. I've never been more wary, you know. In fact, just as I was coming in for this interview, I read that a friend of mine was shot at very close to, inside a place where all of us are often speaking about what is going on, you know. So it's there are so many writers and thinkers and rationalists who've been killed. There are, every day there are lynchings of Muslims and Dalits on the street by mobs who are now putting up those videos on YouTube. And the lynchings are just the most manifest things that you can see. Underneath that lies a marginalization, a pushing out of minority groups from economic activity. Muslims, for example, who have traditionally worked in leather, in meat, in cattle rearing, in dairy, are being killed on the streets when they are just transporting cows. Mm. So, you know, all that activity coming to a dead halt, suddenly out of the blue, you know, beef is banned. But now farmers, you have thousands and thousands of cows who are just being released because no one wants to feed them, including Hindu farmers, once they've stopped producing milk. So you have these thousands of cows stampeding across fields, destroying the crops. Some are kept in cow shelters, they're dying of starvation, or they've been eating plastic because they have no food. So you have a government now that is so obsessed with just this one idea of Hindu nation. You have universities collapsing, you have school textbooks with Hitler on the cover. You have things that are, you know, economically, the Prime Minister a year and a half ago just appeared on TV and said that from 12 o'clock tonight, 80% of the currency will not be legal tender anymore. So it's a kind of micro-fascism, you know, where it's like taking a cricket bat and breaking the spine of every person and seeing, are they going to say anything? Are they going to do anything? Or can I push this a little more? You know, so you have a new tax structure which works for big corporations but has broken the backs again of small business. You have this a thing called UID, a unique identity number, which is going to be now a way of tracking everybody's personal data, which is of course being collected and then hacked. So it's the violence itself is just absolutely terrifying.
You spoke earlier about how this rise of nationalism has made the unsayable sayable in society, and of course India is not alone in grappling with that.
No.
Let's take this one step wider. You're obviously deeply concerned about what is happening in India. Do you share that concern for the world as a home? You only have to look as far as America to see where the unsayable is.
I mean, I was in Germany when the right wing finally comes into the parliament for the first time since the Second World War. I was in Gothenburg with the first largest Nazi march in Europe since the Second World War. So you have to wonder what is fueling this nationalism, and you can see what it is in a pretty clear way. Say, look, during the colonial time, profit for colonizers was driven by moving populations. Like you moved Indians from India to South Africa, you moved Africans to be slaves in the US. You know, all that movement of population was driven by profit for the colonizers. Mm-hmm. Then came the period of globalization when you needed to strengthen the national borders and you needed to only allow capital to move. So cage the people, free the money, let the money move and hold labor within national borders so that they can compete to the bottom for lower and lower wages and so on. Then you have a period where you're now destroying country after country after country in the Middle East. You're creating the ravages of war are forcing immigrants to move to Europe, to America. That is fueling ethno-nationalism, right? And it's the same in India. You have, you know, immigrants coming from Bangladesh, so on, and you have so easily see the connection between the rise of corporate globalization and the rise of, say, Hindu nationalism going in side by side. So the rise of nationalism, the rise of ethno-nationalism, which is only a virulent form of nationalism, is very closely connected to the economic structures, the chosen mode of economic activity, you know. So, and as the resources plummet, as the water table plummets, as resources plummet, you're going to have old tribal identities forming in order to claim those resources. So it's not just that there is a virus of nationalism taking over the world, but it's connected to our chosen form of economic activity, which has become a deep religion. You know, the pursuit of profit is a deep religion, and we feel that there isn't any alternative way of thinking, whereas there has to be.
On that note, we have to wrap up today's conversation, although I wish it could carry on for another hour or more. Arundhati Roy, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And to the members of the audience, thank you so much for being here and for the fascinating questions you've asked.